All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is that podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. Tonight, I got a lot in my mind, and we got a bit of a somber movie, so I might be a bit muted on this one. Not that you can't hear me, but I might be a little bit less peppy than I normally am. But we are going to be talking about a recommended film. Several people were commenting on some of our prior episodes of a Bollywood film. We did Three Idiots with our guest tonight, Jared Wall, and a couple of people were recommending several other Indian films that we got to do. And one of them was the film we're talking about tonight called Sardar Udham, which just came out last year. It's an Amazon film, and we're going to be having a pretty good discussion on it tonight. You can find the show notes more for this at actualanarchy.com/260. And we had a good 35, 40 minutes of pre-show bonus content. So if you do have the Patreon, go listen to that. We were talking about all the things on my mind, and we had a pretty good discussion there. And our guest is going to be probably not able to stick around too much longer after the episode, so there's not going to be a ton of Kathleen Turner overdrive, but we more than made up for it on the front end of this episode. And without much further ado, I'm going to bring on our co-host, Robert Johnson, who oddly enough
Daniel.
Has his actual name on the placard here for the first time in probably months. You've always had a creative and interesting name related to the film, and
yeah.
Tonight you're doing a layup. I figured you'd put a, you know, Sardar Udham Akbar or something, you know, whatever they would whatever would be the right flavor for this film. I don't know what the fuck I'm saying, but anyway, how you doing?
Yeah, he goes under various aliases, and I think there was one Frank Brazil, which was might have been appropriate for me on this one. But I don't know. I just remembered the last half hour of that movie, and I'm like, nah, no jokes. Nothing fun at this one. This is some pretty heavy stuff. So, yeah.
Here I am laughing, as you mentioned, the last 20 minutes of the movie. And
it is hilarious, by the way. Yeah, if you haven't seen the film, that last 20 minutes, it's a real gut buster.
Yeah, hilarious. Well, literally. But yeah.
Indeed.
Hilarity ensues. No, obviously not. But anyway, glad that you're doing well. And as we discussed in the pre-show, there's a lot going on. So I'm going to just leave it there as a teaser so that people can, you know, send us money to hear about my problems. Usually it's the other way around. I have to pay someone to listen to my problems, but not this time. Now it's you guys pay to hear my problems. That's doing the reverse. The doctor is in.
Dan doesn't go to a shrink. He has a podcast. That's what happens.
I just let it out. Anyway.
No therapist needed. I just talking about my problems.
That's right. And I did open the pre-show bonus content with we now have a break in your regularly scheduled clown world with an episode of Sardar Udham, and we will do that with our guest right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us at lastnighters.com, and tonight we're going to be doing the Indian film by way of Amazon called Sardar Udham, and it is a somber affair. It's a lengthy affair, and it has a pretty difficult to watch third act, but it is, of course, the big reveal and the motivation for all of the preceding events you see in the film, and it's quite a watch, and I think we're going to have quite an interesting discussion with quite a guest. And so you can find the show notes more for this one at lastnighters.com/203. And returning to the show, and I feel weird having such a somber movie to talk about when the prior appearance you were on, Jared, was not How High, but Half Baked. But you did do Three Idiots with us, which was a Bollywood film, an Indian film. And so when somebody suggested this one, I was like, who should we call? You're the man. So we called you, and thank you for joining us. I know you've got a couple of projects going on, so why don't you just reintroduce yourself to our audience, and where can they find the various projects that you're working on?
Cool, yeah. Great to be back again. I had a lot of fun last time talking about... honestly, I can't even remember which one we watched now, because we've joked back and forth so many times, whether it's How High or Half-Baked, but it was Half-Baked. So yeah, I had a lot of fun doing that. The reason I suggested that we, that was a Jared, suggested film that we watched, because I wanted basically an excuse to talk about my latest, kind of side hustle endeavor that my wife and I were going about, which is, we started basically, an e-commerce business to hustle Delta 8 cannabis products. So that's still going on. We're doing it at thehempspot.com. That's THCHempspot.com. Get it? Basically it was something that, you know, it was, I figured out that there's basically a loophole that's been found around, political prohibition of this, this plant that I'm a big fan of. Not just for the therapeutic so-called reasons, but for so many reasons, I'm a big fan of the plant. And I'm glad that the market has figured a way around the state. So that's kind of, one of the driving reasons why we chose that, as, even though it's got some risk, involved with it. It's perfectly legal, but it's just in a higher risk class because of the nature of it being cannabis, and it's always subject to the whims of politicians and bureaucrats. So it's a little bit more risky in that sense. the ticker on the bottom is killing me. You're killing my concentration, or like losing my train of thought, laughing at Epstein didn't kill himself. So thank you for that. So thehempspot.com, THCHempspot.com, that's going on there. There's a coupon code for 10% off with I forget even what it was. I think it was last night. Is that what we did?
Daniel? Yes, that is correct. And I will bring that back up on the ticker again. Okay. Last night, word, no space.
Yeah, so that's my biggest, one of my bigger projects outside of, my regular day job. But kind of in correlation with my day job, I started my own podcast, which has yet to air. I'm just recording the initial, episodes 1 through 5 or something. I haven't exactly got everything lined up yet. But hopefully by December or January at the latest, that podcast will be out, and it's going to be called Best Practices. And the general idea is just to take a look and have conversations about how to best own and operate large-scale industrial facilities, manufacturing plants, warehouses, and commercial properties, shopping centers, malls, office buildings, big education. So all different kinds of aspects about anywhere in that could fall under that kind of large umbrella is what I'm aiming at and talking about, which falls under my day job kind of expertise. But those are the two things that I got going on. So again, thanks for being on. I'm looking forward to talking about this movie, as painful as it might be at times.
Right. Well, welcome back. And we will, of course, have all your prior appearances. Not How High, we haven't done that, but perhaps we will at some point in the future. So that when we get confused about it, we'll be like, which episode are we talking about? And of course, I always remember you for the Breaking Liberty website, where you wrote about different takes on the Breaking Bad series.
That's right. That's another project that is still out there. And yeah, that website is live, too. I wrote about Breaking Bad from a libertarian perspective. There's a couple of free ebooks out there at breakingliberty.com. Yeah, thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah, well, there's more I could say, but we've already delayed talking about this movie enough.
Seriously.
So we will get into this with the Google Descripcione, and I think I can make us be three little dudes down at the bottom there. It's kind of cool, right? All right, so this movie, Saradhar Udham, is an Amazon Prime Video movie, came out in 2021, and it's a film based on the life of the Indian revolutionary Udham Singh. And it has a 9 out of 10 on the IMDb for a 2-hour and 42-minute movie, 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, and 94% of Google users liked it. The description is brief. It says, the life of Sardar Udham Singh, a revolutionary freedom fighter best known for assassinating Michael O'Dwyer in London to take revenge for 1919 Jallianwala Bagh massacre in Amritsar. I'm not sure if I'm saying any of these things right, and I apologize in advance. I post apologize for mispronouncing them. But this just came out last month, October 16th, 2021. Directed by Shujit Sarkar. And has some pretty decent acting and actors and actresses. And it was a highly recommended film by a couple of people. And so I thought it might be worthy of doing. So that is our opening with the old Google description. And Robert, we'll go with your opening volley on this one.
Sounds good. Thank you, Daniel. So, I'd never heard of this film before until it was suggested by a YouTube comment. So thank you to whoever suggested it. It's a guy I'd never heard of. It's an event that creates him, that turns him into a radical. And boy, if anybody ever asks him, you know, why did you become a radical? He's got a really good answer. What was I going to say? The movie, the event, I think, was also in Gandhi. Am I right, Daniel? I want to say that scene played out in the movie Gandhi.
I'm not sure.
Remember that?
I remember there was a scene in Gandhi where they're beating the people with sticks and the people are just standing there taking it.
Right. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. They also made I don't know if that was when they were making salt down in the ocean, but I seem to recall that they're Gandhi. I mean, this is happening while Gandhi was alive, of course. Mm-hmm. And I think he responded to this and made some hay out of this event. But as you can imagine, you know, like we've mentioned a million times on the show, when you butcher a whole bunch of people, you don't just solve all your problems. Amazingly enough, it tends to piss people off, tends to make people angry. And I think what Ron Paul said, blowback is the cost of empire, or terrorism is the cost of empire. And this guy's definitely branded as a terrorist. He is a kind of self-described radical communist. And I think that a lot of the British authorities like to call him a communist, but he seems to be, and he hangs out with communists, but you don't get the sense really that he's like the biggest ideology Marxist. Like, he's definitely on that side and he's inspired by those people, but he seems to be more of just a anti-imperialist. Like, he seeks justice. So at some a few points in the film, he does go on the Marxist, socialist, communist worker type guy, like work is slavery kind of stuff. But I tend to think that he kind of more fell in with those people just because they seem to be, I mean, maybe he was already one of them before he was radicalized by the attack, but it seemed to be that he was more motivated by the attack and less by this political ideology. At least it seemed to me, at least that's what came across to me in the film. Maybe he was a radical Marxist and he just so happened to also be one of these, you know, guys seeking justice. But as it's portrayed in the film, before the attack, he's just kind of living. Like, he might have been a member of the party, but he wasn't even at the group with the party, the radical socialists, whatever, DCHP or whatever the name of their party was, I forget. He was just kind of living his life, having this deaf girlfriend, and then he's, you know, dragging bodies to a local semi-hospital in the most brutal, even under, you know, threat of death from this curfew that was also imposed by this British governor at the time.
Yeah, this was Hacksaw Ridge.
It's a really well done film. Yeah. Except he didn't have any qualms about grabbing a gun later on. But yeah, at the time he was definitely just trying to save any lives he could. And that was a really hard ending. But the movie's really well done. I wasn't familiar with any of the actors, but they all did a perfectly fine job. The treatment of prisoners, and specifically him, by Scotland Yard is pretty rough. They definitely don't shy away from their torture techniques. He got waterboarded. He got like nails put underneath his fingernails. He got electrocuted. I don't know, all kinds of, just beat the shit out of him a bunch of times.
Force fed.
That was pretty rough. Yeah, force fed. I want to get into whether it was a justified killing or not. Like if this was really revenge, really justice served, that's definitely a question I want to get into. Because the character that he kills, the governor or the person in charge, I guess, I don't know if it's the governor of Punjab or whatever the guy's name is. He's given like this Teddy Roosevelt speech where he ends up getting shot by Udham. And it seems to be, I don't know if that's just like an idea at the time, but it seems to be really popular around the turn of the 18th, 19th century, where these political figures were really swallowing their own Kool-Aid of how awesome imperialism was and just how savage the rest of the world was and how they had a duty to invade and take control over and dominate and, you know, police, because these people are all just savages and that sort of thing. So I definitely want to get into that. But overall, I could see why this is so well reviewed. Yeah, I think this is going to be end up being a really...
We may have lost you, Robert, but I think you were about to wind down and say...
Oh, am I still there? Hello?
You're there now, yes. Oh, now he's gone. All right. Well, I think he was winding down anyway, Jared.
Sounded that way. Yeah, I mean, he touched on everything or all the main points that I would want to talk about in terms of where, you know, where we can go with a conversation here. The movie itself was fantastic. It was very difficult to watch. It's right up there for me. Like, I loved Three Idiots the first time I watched it. And I really, really liked this movie. I have a couple of qualms with this movie, but I think they're mostly just because I'm, kind of an autistic libertarian who, you know, just can't not think about certain things. And when certain dialogue is put certain ways, it just kind of, you know, triggers me in a little way. I don't even know if my interpretation of the dialogue is necessarily correct in all those cases. But, you know, there's the British Empire stuff to talk about. There's the lingering effects of post-British Empire today in terms of, where borders were drawn and the ongoing conflict between India and Pakistan as a direct result of the British Empire's meddling in India. And the rest of the world through their empire. There's also, you know, there's the correlations you can make to all the British Empire atrocities and tyranny to what the U.S. is doing nowadays, you know, especially with the waterboarding and the torture techniques and basically being an imperial militaristic, world empire. It's the U.S. now. It just kind of slid into the British Empire's old place when Britain collapsed after World War II from all the debt that they had sustained, and the world ended up going with the dollar, but that's a whole another kind of potential way to go with this conversation. There's all kinds of stuff to talk about with this movie. There's some, like I mentioned, there's some specific dialogue that I took a couple of notes during. It was hard to take notes during the movie because there was mostly subtitled, so you had to read the whole movie. So it was very difficult to take notes. But there are a few things that I remember, and they kind of touched on, equality issues and exploitation issues, and kind of the concept of freedom, which is always fun for us Rothbardians to talk about. So all that stuff is great. The way the movie, as you say, the acting I thought was really good. I thought the actor who played O'Dwyer, the guy who got assassinated, I thought he was very hateable. He played that really well. Especially he just looked like such a little pipsqueak, and you know what the shit he was saying, basically, you know, being completely unremorseful for the massacre of 20,000 people or whatever the number was. That was great. And I also loved the way that they told the story. You know, it kind of jumped around a little bit. It felt like the, you know, because it showed the assassination almost right in the very, you know, the first act. And so it kind of felt like, you know, it peaked real quick. But then the way it told the story after that, and it kept linking back, and then it, you know, more and more kind of revealed what led him down that revolutionary path with the ultimate, you know, reveal at the end of, you know, what the big thing was that created him as a revolutionary. Just really, really fantastically done movie. I was kind of waiting for, you know, the actors to suddenly break out into song and dance. But it did not happen. It was really fantastic, really great movie. Bollywood is doing some fantastic things. It makes me want to, I'm always planning on my next appearance on your show. But I know there was another recommendation of what they were described as like the best gangster movie of all time. And it was Wasiapur. Say again.
Gangs of Wasiapur. I'm sure I'm butchering that name as well, but
okay. We're going to have to do that next. Because Bollywood is really doing some stuff. And I loved this movie. And if that gangster movie is, anywhere near as good as this and as good as Three Idiots was, I'm all in for it.
All right. Very good. Well, a lot of things have been brought up, and Robert, it sounds like you're back. So that's good. I don't know if you missed much or we missed much of what you were saying. It sounded like you were about to wind down and hand it off to us. So we can probably pick up from here. So just my initial feedback is this is a really well done film. I do like the structure where you sort of see the culmination of the event, but you don't understand the motivation behind it until near the end. And then they just hammer it home. I mean, that last half an hour, they made the point in the first 5-10 minutes of that, and then it just keeps going and going and going, and that's where you get your 3 hours of length, and it's like, whew, you know, they just really hammer it home. And in a way, I appreciate that, you know, like from a movie making aspect, I'd be like, oh, that's that they overdid that. But I mean, can you imagine what he lived through? You know, it didn't end, right? It just kept going and going until he was at utter exhaustion, and then he kept going from there, trying to get people out of there and save as many lives as he could. And so, you know, if you're trying to like make the audience sort of like intimate just even the tiniest amount of discomfort to share that experience, I think it is effective. And I probably just offended a bunch of people, but I think that's perhaps why they just kept going with it, to make you uncomfortable as a viewer. This is another thing that, this is an event I wasn't familiar with, and I'm sure that there are atrocities and historical events that have happened throughout history in various cultures by various peoples in various places. And history is written by the victors, so you often don't hear about these things because the victors are often justifying to themselves the actions that they have taken and see themselves as the heroes. Robert and I have talked about this many times. So, you know, we get a narrative from the guys who thought they were the good folks. The good guys in most situations. And, but then you also get, you know, some, I would say politicized, attacking of certain cultures and people for politicized reasons. And they tend to ignore, atrocities and other horrible events that were commonplace throughout history. And they tend to pin them on just whatever the current, viewed, you know, power structure or regime or, what's the right term I'm looking for here? But, you know, it's part of the critical theory in general, like whatever the system is, you're against it. So you're always criticizing and taking a negative opinion on everything, even the good things, in a culture or society. And so that's all to say that, I think that this is an area of history that probably wasn't familiar to a lot of people outside of India, save for this film coming out. And so for that, I think it's educational. It's as far as I understand, it's a fairly accurate, you know, portrayal of what occurred. It's a biopic of this man. And I want to get into a couple of the questions that Robert, you'd brought up. You know, was this justified? Is it just revenge? And I think that if it was just revenge, he would have taken that revenge far earlier. And, you know, he worked for the guy. He was in his house, right? He was looking to make a statement. He was not looking to...
Right. He wanted to let people of England know.
Right. And not in a terrorist way, more in a symbolic way. Because also, I mean, this guy did this like so many years prior, and he's an old man. He's what's the average age of you know, human lifespan in the 1930s and 40s, you know? The guy was 75, 76, something like that. He wasn't long for the world. So it's not as if Sardar Udham was killing the guy and robbing him of many years. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a shitty way to look at things, but, you know, killing a young person who has a full life ahead of them feels a bit different than people who are in their 70s and 80s and killed by a governor or two to be, you know, used as fear propaganda to perpetuate a certain narrative. I think you all know what I'm talking about. Speaking of what we all know that I'm talking about, I also noticed that O'Dwyer used this this protest as a collection of his enemies to be made an example of and to instill fear in them. And so that I liken to certain things that we're seeing today, where fear is a powerful motivator and they continue to pile on the fear through propaganda and agitprop. And in the pre-show bonus content, we were talking about people who are blue-pilled and who are buying into that fear and people who are being red-pilled because they're seeing these things not add up anymore. And so that is a bit perhaps the silver lining in these things. But that is one of my fears, is when we see these massive protests happening, or rather don't see because they're often not shown in mainstream media, but they're happening all over the world, New Zealand, Australia, France, Italy, the UK, various cities in the United States, things like that. But you hardly hear about them. Maybe if there were peaceful protests that were, you know, burning down buildings, maybe we'd hear about them. But I wonder if the elites, and I don't even necessarily mean the political class, but I mean like the class who which the political class are like their buffer, if they give a shit that people protest and what effect it actually has, you know, especially when they can control the narrative and squash the appearance of dissent and things of that nature. And so I know I'm straying from the movie. I know, but I do see some similarities in tactics here that that are justified in the 1919 situation, because he wants to instill fear in the populace for political aims. I mean, he's literally a terrorist, the O'Dwyer. He's literally using violence to promote political ends and using fear to keep people from protesting, rising up against the British imperialism. And this is another thing that you often hear when in the years past, I used to debate, you know, socialist types, socialist leaning people, and they would always liken capitalism to imperialism. And I always said, no, those are different things. But you can see why they might think that, especially when you look at, okay, we have the British Empire doing colonial shit, claiming to be capitalists. So obviously it makes a bit of sense that people take them for their word that they're capitalists and they're doing this imperial shit. Therefore, capitalism is imperialism and vice versa. So I know I just rambled all over the place, but Jared, has anything I've said made any sense? And do you have anything that you are interested in responding to? And then we can go to Robert.
I guess I'll touch on that last point that you made about, you know, in terms of, I was just kind of talking to my wife recently about we were talking about, a lot of East Africa, was, under British colonialism. And then when they left, basically, I guess my point was, is that by the time Africa got its independence, and this is, you know, probably not related to the movie exactly, but by the time a lot of African nations got their independence in the early 60s, it was after the glory days of the West was over, and these newly independent nations in Africa. They were either forming governments in reaction against the West or trying to imitate the West, but they were trying to imitate this new West, you know, this 1960s West, which it was just all about democracy and not about property rights and individual liberty and, you know, things like that. Not about, you know, a republic, a limited constitutional republic. You know, the whole everything, the whole focus is on voting and, you know, the fact that it's a democracy. And I think that's where the, you know, the transition went wrong for the, you know, these new country, these new countries. But, you know, the definition of terrorism, that this movie, you know, affords a conversation about is really interesting too, because they labeled him, this Udham Singh, a terrorist in their newspapers, just the same way that the U.S. today labels Muslims who react against U.S. imperialism and decades of U.S. planes dropping bombs on their land.
Or bombs at school board meetings.
Yeah, right.
Things get pretty loose in their definitions these days.
Yeah, that's for sure. So yeah, just all that. And, but you know, it's foreign policy when you mow down a, peaceful protest of Indians gathering to talk about, you know, the latest, rights reducing and eliminating dictate that your colonial power just passed. That they're going to have to now be subject to, and you know, so they all gather in the square to discuss it calmly and politely, and they were all sitting there Indian style. And I don't really know if we really want to give away all the details of that last 30 minutes of the movie, but it really reminded me of that scene in 12 Years a Slave, where he's being punished by basically being pseudo hung from the, they hang him to the point where he can touch the ground only on his tippy toes. And they leave him there for hours and hours, and so he's up, you know, he's stretched out as far as he can go, and his, you know, if he takes any weight off of his tippy toes at all, you know, he would hang himself essentially. And they leave him there for hours and hours and hours, but the scene in the movie goes on forever and ever and ever. I remember I felt that way the first time I saw it, and he's just hanging there, you know, and he can't hardly breathe, and he's struggling for water, and this girl, you know, takes pity on him, you know, a fellow slave girl takes pity on him and, you know, sneaks him a sip of water when nobody's looking, and then runs away real quick to, you know, to make sure that she doesn't get caught. It was a really, really powerful scene. I remember when I watched it, and the scene in this movie, at the end of it, that last 30 minutes put that, you know, it kind of took that to a whole nother level.
I remember, yeah. The Last Temptation of Christ took a fair amount of screen time the, you know, punishment endured by Jesus. And so it does seem to be a tactic, or a, I don't know what the right term is, but like a, you know, it's an intentional thing that they're doing in the filmmaking process to make you at least have an awareness of a shared experience of how terrible that is, you know, and by making it so long that it like feels too long is the point, you know? And I also think that related to the imperialism, equating that to capitalism, and therefore if you're against imperialism, you have to be a socialist. But then they also talk about the exploitation and that the reason that the imperialism is there is for the natural resources and the raping of the land and things like that. So it gives a lot of like weight to the story or the narrative of those opposed to capitalism. And so I can kind of see where they would get those ideas from these historical events. and you know, unfortunately, they're, you know, economically illiterate, especially some of their professors who make the rounds on podcasts and other interviews. One of them debated Gene Epstein at the Soho Debate Forum, and it was terrible. The guy was awful.
I remember his name.
I do. Yeah, I almost don't want to say his name. He's so terrible.
Don't want to give him even like the.
Yeah, his name's Richard Wolff.
You can find it on the Soho website.
Yeah, Richard Wolff, and he had a.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
A tweet of like, you know, the reason prices are going up isn't money printing or inflation. It's greedy capitalist ketchup companies. It's fucking ridiculous. Guy's an absolute clown. But you know, he's at a prestigious university as a professor of economics with a PhD. So what do I know? I'm just a guy sitting in a fucking box in my driveway. But but I will say, just hearkening back to my prior rambling rant, I have found allegiances in resisting the COVID regime tyranny with people who are economically illiterate and who believe in the socialist Marxist economics. There's a couple of folks on Facebook who I have had debates with in the past, and usually those devolve very rapidly into ad hom and other nefarious non-debate tactics. But a handful I've had good debates with, and we had a mutual respect for each other, and so we friend requested each other. And one of them has been posting very good things about what's going on in the world today with the overreach of government and all of those things. And so he and I have connected via DM, and we are aligned in resistance to a common enemy, even though we view economics and how the world works in totally different ways, you know, and to that, to me, that's like a bit of a silver lining as well, in that now there is something that people can align against and can bring people together.
And today, that's the most important thing to be against. So if you're going to be aligned on that, then the economic disagreements, that can be decided at a later date, you know, whatever.
Well, to me, together. I mean, they're interlinked, but
to an extent, but if my
economic policies were in place, there would not be the concentration of power to be able to do any of this shit.
Right.
And if he had his way, they'd have zero resistance to it, or, you know, like they'd have ultimate authority.
So, yeah, hopefully more conversations lets him connect those dots himself in his own brain. Is Robert dropped out completely? Can we hear his voice and just not his video, or do you know?
What do you think, guys? Can you hear me fine, or what do you think?
We can hear you. Yeah. Yep. I think, your limited internet going to no video is probably helpful. So I know we've said a lot of stuff. I've sidetracked us, derailed us several times, and I'm sure you got a steam of energy to fire away.
I've got a few things I can mention. I apologize for my connection. Yeah, it seems to be hit or miss tonight, a little bit sketch. So I want to go back to that thing Daniel was talking about, the O'Dwyer ordering the hit. When he does have that phone call to the general, it very much reminded me, like, all of a sudden I was watching The Sopranos and it was Tony Soprano like talking to his capo. And he's like, we need to send a message to these people. I mean, he danced all the way around it without actually saying, yeah, go and shoot these people in the face.
Yeah. No culpability or no.
Plausible deniability. He's like, I never said anything. What are you talking about? Now, after the film, or the very, very end, right before the credits roll, they interview the O'Dwyer and the general guy. And as we've talked about a million times, people are the heroes of their own story. And I want to know, or at least I have a question for you guys. Did it seem like, because they, in their mind, or at least what they said was, hey, we saved millions of lives, or hundreds of thousands of lives by taking a few lives. So it was like a 10-to-1 save. We're the heroes. I mean, all of a sudden these guys are perfect prognosticators. They had the perfect knowledge of what was going to happen in the future. And if they didn't shoot all these people, it was going to lead to this massive communist revolution and everybody was going to die or whatever.
It was for their own good.
It is for their own good. It is for the good of overall for India. Now, does that ring hollow to you, or did it, because it kind of smacked of ex post facto justification, like, yeah, we killed them, but it would have been worse had we not. Like, same with like every governor and their COVID policies for the past year and a half. Yeah. It's just endless. Yeah, it's bad, but it would have been worse if we had done nothing.
When at the end of the film, when were those interviews to have been taking place? It was the Hunter Commission, I think, which was looking into the events that occurred in 1919. So it must have been a few years past.
Probably back in, in Britain.
Okay. I wonder if there was an awareness in the world of the Bolshevik Revolution and the millions of people who died as a result of that. But I think like a lot of those, you know, famines.
Well, this is 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution. So.
Right. But I don't know if there was an awareness of the millions of deaths, because a lot of them hadn't occurred yet. Right. Like, wasn't
right.
The whole Holodomor, I'm saying it wrong, but you know, Holodomor, what I'm saying?
But, yeah, well, that was later. Mm-hmm. That was as a result of Stalin's policies in Ukraine. Yeah.
If there were communism, then millions would die. I mean, maybe they thought that, but I kind of doubt it. I mean,
No. In 1919, there were New York Times articles. I don't know, crazy. Not 1919, but in throughout the 20s, there were New York Times articles talking about how Russia was the great miracle and how it was fantastic and awesome and working perfectly and super sweet.
Right. But if we look at it back from today, we could say, well, yeah, if it had gone communist, then yeah, probably more people would have died. I mean, probably.
Right. Probably. But that's really putting on your wizard hat and going, if we don't shoot all these people right now, in 20, 30 years, we're going to, you know, lose half the population or something like that. That's just nonsense.
Well, and it goes back to the ends and means situation. You know, to me, the means you employ flavor the ends. So even if you think it, you're justifying it. If you use evil means, then you've committed evil acts, you know?
Yeah.
That's the nature of how the state just justifies itself. You compare the way Dyer and O'Dwyer justify themselves for what they did in what's it called, Armistar there. Yeah. You know, the same way to governors and whatnot are justifying their COVID lockdowns today, to the same way that the neocons would justify their whole Middle Eastern adventurism and militarism.
Yeah, that was another Soho debate that was recently with Scott Horton
and Bill Kristol recently. And Bill Kristol took the whole position that, the U.S. had to be engaged around the world over the last 75 years so that we could prevent nuclear war. If the U.S. had not been engaged throughout the world for the last 75 years, you know, Korea was great, Vietnam was, you know, necessary and good, you know, and the whole Middle East, you know, that, yeah, there were some mistakes made, but, you know, think about it. There have been no nuclear wars, and that's because of our engagement. You know, it's all the same kind of thing. They use that kind of nasty phrase, you know, this is the white man's burden. And, you know, these people are savages and they just can't take care of themselves. And, you know, there's kind of a version of that happening with how the U.S. is justifying stuff. And, you know, the Muslims and people, Arabs and Middle Easterners are very much
bad at democracy. We got to show them how to do democracy right.
Yeah, because they don't know how to do it. They just keep letting themselves get ruled by these dictators. So we got to go give them democracy.
Yeah,
thank God they're going to greet us as liberators.
You're just one murder away from a good democracy or something. Is that the saying?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and you know this whole justification of utilizing fear and evil atrocities to prevent what they thought might be a worse outcome. I can liken that to the bombs dropped on Japan, where they ex post justify that, saying, well, you know, a land invasion would have cost so many more lives, et cetera, or more likely, we're going to demonstrate to the rest of the world that we're the baddest motherfuckers around and we're willing to drop something like this. And so don't fuck with us, which they might in their heads justify. Well, that's saving millions of lives, right? Because now we've got this mutually assured destruction detente situation. I guess at that time they would have been like, no one's going to mess with us as long as we're the only ones who have this. So it's another evil atrocity that those perpetrators would use to justify in their own heads. And I can see that in a psyche type situation. Like, you sort of have to view yourself as doing something good, even if it is evil. You have to justify it. Otherwise, how can you live with yourself?
Right. I think it would give me a little more credibility, or give O'Dwyer a little more credibility, though, if he willingly accepted that what he did was necessary, understanding that there should be, I mean, he thinks of himself as a hero, but he has to understand that he is not a hero to the people of India.
Right.
I mean, he can't possibly be that obtuse, right? I mean, yeah, he's in his cups, he's at his hearth, and he's justifying it and about how great he was and whatever, but that seems to be like he's trying to sleep at night, honestly.
I think he's so far away from it, and he doesn't see it ever. He probably never even saw a photo of it, much less, you know, like, was there on site after the fact to see the the after effects.
You know,
you think that's part of it, or because
I don't. I think that people who are involved in these atrocities, it doesn't affect them anymore. Like, I notice it when they were torturing Sardar Udham in the Scotland Yard. The guys were, the prison guards were just going along with it. You know, they're just people, you know, yeah. And they're doing these awful, horrific things to this man. So I think that there becomes a normalization of these things, perhaps over the course of time, to where what we would look back on and be like, how could they allow that to happen? You know, that's what Stanley Milgram sought to study, right? He was like, how could people have committed these things? Well, they listen to authority or whatever, you know, and so they don't feel culpable, or they've offloaded the decision to, well, this authority figure told me to do it, therefore it's not really me, so therefore I can do it and I don't have to feel guilt about it. And so I don't know. I think it plays into the, you know, still with that human nature, kind of like a way to compartmentalize things, justify things, view yourself as a hero. So even if you're witnessing atrocities, seeing atrocities, committing atrocities, I don't know if it impacts you as well, because there's like these protection mechanisms in place with how you perceive the world. And I think that's one of the things that maybe gets preyed upon when there is that concentration of power and authority. Anyway, that's my 2 cents. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm making sense tonight. I feel like I'm going on these rambling rants.
Yeah, I mean, not really, but you know, it's all good. No, you're doing fine, Dan. You're doing great. So are we all in agreement here that this assassination was justice? I mean, clearly he didn't just kill him as soon as he had the chance. He wanted to bring awareness to the situation, which the judge basically shut down.
That's kind of like, you know, heroic justice, you know, like
he called it protest.
He wanted to make sure he did it. He wanted to assassinate somebody. He wanted to assassinate somebody in a certain way such that it would be known that it was an assassination. A revolutionary assassination. I think that's what he wanted himself to be remembered as, was he wanted to be a revolutionary. But I mean, in terms of it being justified, it was not only justified, but it was really, you know, it was heroic. Nobody deserves to be killed more than somebody like O'Dwyer. And, you know, whether there's not really a death that's bad enough for some of these people, people like the counterparts to O'Dwyer that exist today, the counterparts to Dyer that exist today, who marched their soldiers out there. I kind of give the soldiers a pass, because people sometimes are, you know, so day to day that, you know, the salary is, you know, but, you know, once they say pull the trigger and then
the thing
everybody
stood out to
around
me
you
was
is shooting
those,
like
those ooh. Were Indian soldiers, right?
Yeah, they were Indian soldiers. And that's a good, thanks for bringing that up, because that's what the British Empire was notorious for, is they were really, really good at splitting up the local populations to, you know, to be in conflict with each other and using one to be their enforcement arm, you know, kind of boots on the ground.
Yeah, people. That was what the Hutu and Tutsi thing, and that was the Dutch, right?
Yep, that was the Belgians.
Belgians, I'm sorry to the freaky deaky Dutch. It's the Belgians.
Yeah, but the French came in there during the genocide time period during the early 90s when all that was going on. So you're not wrong that it was the French then, but it was the Belgians who colonized them. But it was Britain who colonized Kenya, and they were the Kenyan. I forget what they called them, but the Kenyan basically version of those Indian soldiers who fired on the crowd were very notoriously brutal and would, you know, were the main lines of fighting against the Mau Mau revolution that rose up in Kenya to fight against the British imperialism. And I wish, honestly, I feel bad for our listeners. I wish I knew more about Indian resistance to British imperialism, because I think that would do this movie a lot more justice. But I know British imperialism in general was just extremely, extremely harsh. I've got a friend that I worked with at my last job who was from the Kashmir region, you know, which is the kind of the disputed territory between India and Pakistan these days. And he, to this day, you know, and he's too young to, you know, he's only a couple years older than I am. He hates the British, and it's just, you know, for good reason. And like I say, I wish I knew more about the history of British imperialism as it specifically relates to India and as well as Indian resistance to it. But I know that today, you know, the ongoing conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir is the remnants of British imperialism. And I also know that the U.S. foreign policy has done nothing to try and calm those waters. All they've done on the other hand is, you know, just fan the flames of that conflict. And that's a very dangerous conflict flames to be fanned, if I can try and speak here, but, you know, because they got nuclear weapons pointed at each other. So that's a dangerous, dangerous situation that is persisting to this day because Britain wanted to exploit, in the literal sense of the term, the resources and the, you know, probably labor of the Indian people during their, you know, expansionist empire period. So that's, you know, like you say, that's my two cents there. But I wish we could do a little bit better justice to this movie, but it was a fantastic movie. And Udham Singh really, really should, you know, be much more well known than he is. Cause I'm like you, I didn't hear of this event prior to the movie and I hadn't heard of him prior to the movie, but I'm glad I do.
Yeah. So I have a whole line of questions I think could lengthen our episode by probably too much. So I want to bring Robert back in for, I'm sure he's got a bit more to say. And then Jared, you had mentioned that you had a couple of quotes that you thought, you wanted to discuss, and then we can start winding this one down. It's been good so far, I think. So Robert, you have the floor.
Well, hopefully my internet is fine, but it keeps popping in and out and it's turning you both into robots at different times. So hopefully I'm not a robot right now. I'm grateful for watching this film. I had never even heard of the Bengal famine. 4 million people dead, and I'd never heard of it. So if that's not a case of history being written by the winners and ignoring the result of their atrocious and horrific policies, the fact that Winston Churchill, I mean, I don't know the details, but the movie attributed to Winston Churchill's World War II policy, which I assume diverted food from the Bengal region of India to the front lines or wherever else he thought it was necessary, a result of central planning, just like Stalin in the Holodomor, deciding, you know, who's more important, who gets to live, who gets to die. I'm interested to look into it. I want to learn more. Because, you know, Winston Churchill, he's a hero to, I'm sure, a lot of British people, and probably a lot of people just in the West in general. Mm-hmm. Sure. As a guy who stood up to Hitler and helped win World War II and all these kinds of things. And he had a lot of fun quotes, and he was a smart guy, but you know, he's just like this perfect dude. I mean, even though I think he only killed a few people in like Africa and the wars when he was fighting in those, it wasn't until he got into politics where, you know, the body counts really rack up. That's where you can really get a lot of kills under your belt. But I'd never even heard of the Bengal famine, so I want to look into that. And I'm surprised that they killed that many people in India. And I mean, they probably still have a presence in India. I mean, I know it's not considered a territory of Britain anymore, but like in the film,
yeah.
Is it still considered a Commonwealth?
Yeah, but it's its own country. It's like Canada is a Commonwealth, New Zealand's a Commonwealth, Australia's a Commonwealth. So there's some, you know, transitory privileges between those countries. If you're a citizen of one, I think it's easier to go into another and live there.
I see.
I don't know the details, but yeah, they're still related in some ways.
Yeah. Well, I can see why people would hate the British for all the horrific crap. Go ahead, Jared.
Speaking of something else, I'd want to look further into, you mentioned the Bengal famine. I'd also really like to learn more about, you know, not just Udham Singh, but also Bhagat Singh, who I guess was kind of his like revolutionary cohort. They didn't really talk about him too much in the movie, but I remember Bhagat Singh when he was being tortured, one of his torturers brought up that name and he said, don't talk about him. Like that was the only time he actually like really engaged with what the torturer was asking him. Was when he brought up Bhagat Singh, and I kind of quickly looked to just refresh my memory, but he in the movie, and I remember him mentioning this in the movie, them going into the details of this in the movie, that he had been a revolutionary there in India, you know, was fighting against the British people there locally in India, and had successfully assassinated at least one kind of higher up British person there. And then he was imprisoned, and then I think hanged or otherwise brutally murdered after kind of a show trial. And so, yeah, just one other thing that, the movie didn't really get too much into, but, you know, like I was saying, you know, I kind of wish I knew more. That's, you know, the Bengal famine and Bhagat Singh, you know, those are two things where I think that would be, you know, kind of a next step in trying to learn more about the whole aspect of British imperialism and British Empire in India. And that was I didn't know that about the Commonwealth thing. I thought they were all like literally their own complete 100% separate countries. I didn't know that or is it just kind of an agreement type thing? And that I feel like I learned something new just now.
I mean, I'm just recalling from probably grade school.
Okay.
So I don't know a whole lot about it, but I just think it's like an affiliation of formerly empire held countries that are now sovereign, but there are some relationship between them that makes it easier for certain things to occur, trade and travel, you know, in the olden days, like 2019 and before. Now you guys talked about like the Bengal famine and wanting to know more about these things. I also want to know about more of these historical atrocities, but not just, you know, by the British Empire, but any empire or any government. I mean, it'd be great to have an awareness of all the various cultures that have done terrible things and have an understanding that it's not a unique thing to one particular demonized culture of today. I think it's been par for the course for generations. And I think that it gets politicized and pushed into a certain direction for destabilizing effects, for demoralization effects, and for critical theory effects, you know. But as it relates to the film, I felt like the significance of Bhagat Singh was a little bit lacking. Like, I didn't get a sense of, like you mentioned, he reacts to the torture when Bhagat Singh is brought up, and they do devote a little bit of screen time to their relationship and how he was a mentor, and they had that one thing where he's speaking at one of their it looked like a textile type, you know, mill, and he was very intelligent and witty and funny and had charisma. But I felt that perhaps in the film they didn't devote enough time for why Udham Singh was so devoted to him. You know, I didn't get the closeness of their relationship. That wasn't like firmly established for me. So just from a filmmaking aspect, I felt like that was maybe not hammered home as much, but maybe that was so that they could devote more of the runtime to hammering home the horrendous motivations at the end there.
We'll go to Robert. Yeah. No, I could agree with all that. It's definitely, it's kind of a surprise when he says, don't mention that name. It's like, why not? I've seen the movie and your story up to this point, and there's nothing that tells me that this is some kind of a sacred relationship, other than that he was kind of your revolutionary mentor and kind of taught you the ways of revolutionary socialism and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, being someone who's completely against socialism, I still had complete sympathy for him as a revolutionary anti-imperialist justice seeker. I just kind of wish that, you know, he wouldn't necessarily take out his frustrations on like the owner of a small business or whatever, when he's talking about this work is slavery and that kind of thing. That was a little bit cringy, but you know, that's the way it goes. I mean, they are against any kind of hierarchy at all and the private property and all that. So they're going to have some silly ideas, but in terms of seeking justice for mass murder, I'm on board.
Yeah, hear. Jared, let's get into your quotes that you would wanted to nitpick about. We can be autistic for a few minutes, or you know, the entire time, and then we'll get into some final summary review and give it some scores.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I think that the two quotes that I have written down, not really necessary that I would nitpick, and I think that was more kind of a general comment. But I remember right in the beginning of the movie, when it's before it's really explained why he has become a revolutionary, he's explaining to I think it was a cousin, I'm gonna move to London, forget if he explains just out and out what his intentions are. But she knows that he's going there to be quote revolutionary, and she says to him, she's kind of begging him not to go, and she says, "You all just want to kiss the noose." And I thought that was a really interesting quote. It kind of resonated with me for a few seconds after, you know, as the movie kept going, kind of lost myself in that quote, and kind of just, you know, just. You kind of feel for her because, you know, obviously there's a very strong, powerful reason why Udham would want to be a revolutionary. But, he's got family that he's leaving behind to go do that. And she knows that when he leaves to go do what he's going to go do, she's not going to be able to see him again because it's going to result in, you know, his imprisonment for the rest of his life at best and his execution at worst. So I was really taken with that quote really early in the movie, and that, you know, that I was hooked into this movie very early. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I felt like, oh, the dialogue's really good. The acting is really good. The cinematography was excellent, and it just, the whole movie was great that way. But that's one quote that I had thought of. Any thoughts on that from either of you?
I read that as, she was trying to dissuade him from doing what he was going to do and saying, you know, you just want to kiss the noose. Like, you just want to like live dangerously.
You just want to go be a martyr, basically.
Yeah, take a risk that's unnecessary when you could just live your life out But this is also before we know the motivation is revealed mm-hmm. at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it, I guess in a way it sort of puts you in a, puts you a little bit off balance, you know, like yeah. you don't understand how strongly motivated he is at that point. You just know that he wants to do something. And she's like, just kind of,
right.
Maybe she knows what he's experienced, but you as an audience don't know. So she's saying it one way, but we're hearing it as, oh, you know, he's making a choice to do this because he wants to live dangerously. He's assuming a greater risk than he might otherwise. But and I think that that's due to the nature of how they tell the story. Whereas if we knew up front the atrocity they open with that, well, then that bit of dialogue means something different as a viewer. If they use it after yeah. you know the atrocity.
Yeah, that's a really cool way of looking at it. I'm obviously not a professional movie reviewer. So like putting that way of looking at it, together in my head, it makes perfect sense why it would stick out to me more, you know, because I don't know what the real motivation is. I think he's just, you know, he just wants to be a revolutionary. And she doesn't want him to, and she loves him, and you know he's not taking that into account, you know, just because of the, you know, that wild and free, and you know, go wild west, be a revolutionary. But you know, yeah, cool. Thanks. That helped me think about that from a different way. So I like that.
Well, and I will give you your professional movie reviewer badge when you've done your 10th episode.
Okay. I don't know exactly. I'd have to add it up.
You're close.
I think it's more than five.
Yeah, halfway there. Okay. Whoa, we're halfway there. All right, Living on a Prayer. We are actually near the end of our time. So
yeah.
Did you have another quote that you wanted to
It wasn't really a quote. It was, another topic that we could potentially talk on real quick if you want. It would be, you know, the nature of state propaganda. You know, there were a couple good examples of the British's use of propaganda. There was some World War II. I remember there was a kind of like a, not really an air raid siren, but like a national or a town crier, like PA system kind of was set up. And I forget exactly what it was announcing, but it was very almost kind of comical, like the level of propaganda it was related to World War II, and I forget the exact details, but it was something about maybe even, you know, the Germans and calling them a certain word, or, you know, I don't remember, but I remember that. But I remember also because he was so engaged with the IRA, the Irish Revolutionary something
Army. Yeah. Republican Army,
Irish Republican yeah. Army, yeah, the Irish Revolutionary Group, when there was a big, I guess, raid on a store of arms that the IRA had that was going to be transferred to the Indian Revolutionary cause, and the British government made a big deal out of that. And I don't remember if it was in radio or on a clip of a newspaper that they showed, but it said, you know, called it acts of sabotage against the state is what the people were going to be charged with. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting terminology that's what they were being charged with acts of sabotage against the states, you know, and just shows who they're looking out for. Who's number one to the state? It's the state, you know, it's not the people.
Yeah. There's a great quote. I think it's a Rothbard quote. It's about, you know, who do you think the state is really looking out for, themselves or for you? Who do they prosecute when something happens against the state? Are they more severe when it's against the state versus against a citizen? Well, I think if you look at January 6th, you would see, yes, they are very much more aggressive about things that are against the state. And I don't recall if the raid was this scene or not, but there was a scene where a young boy was running away with some pamphlets and the police shot him running away, clearly not a threat to the police. And just, you know, probably quote unquote justified and exonerated, but definitely not something that should have occurred. And that might've been a separate raid. I know that there was one time when Udom was going to get a gun originally, and then they raided that. And then I think this was another raid where he was going to meet with them somewhere. I get a little fuzzy in these long movies with what's going on, but anyway, I think my point was they shot that kid unnecessarily and in a very evil way.
Yeah, one last thing I want to mention before we wrap up. This movie does an excellent job of displaying the attitude of kind of like the mentality at the time of the British in the middle of their this massive empire that they control, of, you know, that they had some kind of divine right to do it, and that any kind of resistance to their rule is met with, you know, absolute violence and quick retribution. And how could you? This is an atrocity. You people are monsters. We have to rule. we're super playing the victim, and we have to deal with shit as harshly as possible because we can't let this kind of thinking that there's any kind of justified right of them to resist our aggression. So it really gave us the idea like, well, of course we rule Ireland, and how dare they fight back, or anybody would dare fight attack us. Why are they attacking us? I don't even understand. Why would any of these Indian guys want to hurt anybody here in Britain? We're awesome. We do great things. We're fantastic. The empire is a force of good.
Yeah.
So it's a real, the mental gymnastics that people go through to justify their own abhorrent behavior and support for the empire. Like, they benefit from all this aggression. And so, of course, to them, it's all fantastic. And then they only get the good news from their propaganda arm. And I mean, it's the same thing here. It's the same thing in any empire. But I do want to give a shout out to my boy Udom. At his trial, he was a boss, just talking to the judge, telling everybody the truth, basically. It was fantastic. I really appreciated his dialogue in that scene.
Of course, the judge told the media, you can't report on anything he said. And that was
See who's the boss of that. The state, when the state tells the media what to do, gives them their marching orders.
Yeah, well, apparently those comments he made were sealed for 50 years.
And they're still sealed, right? Aren't they?
No, they
I thought the movie said that there were still secret documents that haven't been revealed yet.
I'm sure there are some, but I think what he said in the court hearing was revealed maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago, something like that. I was reading a little bit about it, and of course anything I read, it comes in one ear out the other, you know, kind of comes.
Well, according to in the film, it said at the very, very end that there are still sealed secret documents that have not been revealed about this guy.
I'd believe that. You mentioned
probably because of COVID. You know how it is.
Yeah, you know, it's why the JFK thing got delayed, right?
That's right.
So you mentioned Ireland, and it reminds me of this great Ralph Rako lecture. I think it's about this period of time, World War I to World War II, and he says, you know, the British see themselves as great and standing up for the rights of the people to make self-determination, and he cracks a joke. Someone in the back of the audience says, what about Ireland? And he was taken out back and shot. But in this very dry, you know, witty humor that Ralph Rako has in this beautiful, you know, baritone voice. He passed away a couple years ago, but his lectures are amazing and a lot of fun to listen to. Yeah. Anyway, we should start winding it down. We were going long as we want to do here. So, Robert, do you want to just take us down that path of final summary review and how many volleys out of 10 are you having the firing squad do against the peaceful people? Meeting.
I don't want them to do any volleys, Daniel. What's wrong with you?
All right. So
zero.
I'm going to give this movie a 0 out of 10. No, the movie. Okay. So Sardar Udham, should you watch it? Absolutely. I want to learn more. It's obviously something that's been whitewashed over and forgotten in history. And I'm glad movies like this are being made. It's an absolute crime what happened. And it's a crime that's been covered up. And it's a crime that's continued to be covered up. People should know that empire is aggression. It's not this benevolent thing that these people are going over and just making these savages, you know, I think that's more and more known, but it's often the CRT people and the critical theory people that are just upset with everything. They come at it with this almost cartoonish view. I don't think you need to take it that level to realize that it's horrific. Trade is the benefiting factor, not the empire and the ruling and the aggression. You can benefit everybody by just trading with them. You don't have to go in with soldiers and forcibly dominate them. And I think we're all well aware of that. Sardar Udhum, it's a very well interesting territory story. It's interesting that they end on the atrocity, and that really makes it really you leave with it. You know, you're going to hold on to that atrocity. You're going to remember that scene for a long time. I think by the way they ended on it, you get a sense that he is, you know, a dedicated person to this cause that he has, and he's talking about it throughout the film. But when you see it for yourself, then you really become a fan of his, in the sense that, yeah, somebody needs to go out and get justice for this atrocity. These people can't just, you know, well, I did it as a matter of doing my job, doing my duty for the state, so I'm a good person. I think there's some humanity in that guy. And I was a little upset that he didn't, I don't think he got killed, right, by Udhum. It was him. It's just O'Dwyer that got killed, and then a few other guys got injured, right? It wasn't the general guy. He didn't get shot at all?
No, he had already died.
Okay.
Yeah, Udhum visits his grave, actually, in the film.
Oh, I must have missed that part. Okay. Okay, anyway. Yeah.
And as a score, maybe a number of cartloads of people you've saved, or that were saved, out of 10. That's maybe a better...
is that better? That's still a pretty morbid. No, I got an idea of what I'll do. I'm going to go with a revolutionary fist in the air. How about that? It's well acted. I definitely see more of this director's work. It's well directed. The cinematography is excellent. I was just impressed with the entire production. I thought it was all quite good, especially doing a period piece. It all looked great. So I thought that the storytelling was quite interesting. It wasn't exactly your typical story. I thought it was well told. It jumped around a little bit. And then there are a little bit of time jumps where I wasn't quite sure what was happening, especially when he's like going to Russia and then he's not. Then he's going to Russia and he's back in England and whatnot. But I understand he was moving around a lot during that time. And I'm not sure they necessarily needed to have all that in the film. But overall, I can't really fault any of the storytelling. I thought it was all quite well done. So I'm going to go with 9 revolutionary fists in the air for Sardar Udhum. RIP Sardar. Hopefully you will not be long forgotten.
All right. Very good. Well, I think that's a pretty good take and a very good score. I saw some reviews related to this film calling it a masterpiece. And I think that there are some arguments to be made for that. I think that there are a couple of areas that maybe could have been done a little bit differently, but I do like the overall narrative structure where you sort of open with the ambiguity. So you don't really understand what the motivations really are. I mean, you probably have an idea. They do talk about some of the things that are happening and some of the mistreatment of his people and the exploitation and the lack of being able to choose their own destiny, things like that. But it really is driven home at that end scene. And it just goes on and on and on. And I think to good effect. That's actually a quote in the film. I think he says that they fire to good effect. So I didn't mean to do that, but I think that it is effective in storytelling and in making the film to leave that with your audience and maybe leave them wanting to know more about these things. And I think adding those little title cards at the end where they talked about the Bengal famine and one other event that another million or so people died as a result of, it's like a stepping stone into, okay, you've seen this, you're affected by it. Here's something else to look at. It's sort of like a red pilling kind of thing. I guess that's a theme of mine tonight. So it makes people interested to look into more of these things. And that is an effective way, I think, that you can get some interest in things that would otherwise go unseen. So for that, I think this is an effective piece and it's a well-done film, well-acted, well-structured, well-done. And I'm going to give it 8.5 raised fist. So, you know, like a Gage Grosskreutz half. But the other one is the 8. Have you seen the trial? It's a fucking shit show. Clown show. Prosecution.
I've seen some updates. I've seen some, yeah, some commentators talking about it. It's been. Yeah,
but there's two different realities, though, man. Like the blue check mark Twitter. They think it's all he's totally guilty and evil and white supremacist. And then people who have eyes to see are like, what the fuck is the prosecution even doing? But anyway.
Yeah.
Jared,
I think one of the things you mentioned, the tile cards, was that 2.3 million Indians died in World War II fighting for the British.
Oh, right. Yep. Yep. That was one of them. Yep. Conscripted? Probably.
Most likely, but.
All right, Jared, take us home, buddy.
Yeah. I don't really have much more to add on top of everything we've talked about. I mean, I think, you know, one of the, I could get more people to hear that, you know, none of this stuff could happen if it weren't for, you know, lower people down the chain being willing to enforce it. And that massacre wouldn't have happened if, you know, the people hadn't been willing to pull the triggers. These lockdowns, you know, all the protests that you brought up earlier, Daniel, you know, a lot of those have been pretty violently broken up in a lot of cases, you know, with tear gas and rubber bullets and you know, worse in some cases. And so none of this would be happening if it weren't for cops. You know, to me, some of the coolest people I've ever met are ex-cops, you know, young men who were cops for a short while and then quit because they just couldn't do it for one reason or another. And a lot of the reasons are usually reasons that, you know, those who think like us would approve of, you know, as good reasons why somebody would quit being a cop. And, you know, I'm really glad, you know, like you say, I forget which one you said it, but I'm really glad this movie was made. It's an opportunity to learn more about state atrocity. You know, it's a good jumping off point for Britain and India specifically. And I think, you know, I would like to try as best I can to leave with a little bit of a positive note, and just that, you know, the fact that this movie did get made and the fact that, you know, there are so many different platforms for really, really solid content to be put out on. There's just the market competition out there is vast, which is very, very good for the consumer. And so there is just going to be so much entertaining and informative, educational, whatever you're really looking for, all that kind of content is out there. And all that's only possible because of, you know, capitalism. You know, we brought up a little bit earlier about how capitalism is kind of associated with this old imperialism. And, you know, that's why I don't really like the word capitalism. I'd prefer to use, you know, when I'm talking about those kind of ideas, I like to talk about the market as opposed to talking about capitalism. But, you know, in people's heads, capitalism is, you know, buying and selling things and a government and bombs dropping and, you know, soldiers and police enforcing authoritarianism. So those things are all unfortunately connected in a lot of people's heads. You know, hopefully we can take advantage of, you know, what the market has provided in terms of competition for content creators and the ability to put content out there, that maybe we can change some of those minds. And, you know, as this seemingly, you know, as it seems like this current order is finally crumbling, hopefully we'll be able to build it back up better than what it was prior. So yeah, hopefully that that wrapped things up there nicely. I kind of managed to bring it together in my head there. Anyways, I always like talking with you guys. I don't know if you're going to do a Kathleen Turner. I'm probably going to bow out. So Daniel, if you did have, you know, one last question that you were hanging on here, go ahead and ask it, but I want to give it 9.5 star, or not stars, but fists in the air. Can I give 9.5 bullets to O'Dwyer's torso? Can I? Maybe that's a little bit too dark, but I think he only got 2 or 3.
It's the third darkest of the options. So
okay, but it's in the right direction, I think, at least. Great movie. Thanks.
Okay, well, I hope you can stick around for just a little bit longer. We're going to wind down here and maybe just for a few minutes, keep talking. In a little bit of Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is available for our Patreon supporters. We did about 35, 40 minutes of pre-show bonus content, which will explain what I'm about to tell everyone now. There is a lot going on, as I discussed in the pre-show bonus content, and it may affect my ability to devote the resources, time, and energy to the show. So at this time, I don't have a show lined up for next week and potentially for several weeks thereafter. I'm not going to rule out doing a show. If something comes up where there's just something we got to do and there's time to do it and we got a guest lined up and all of that. But for right now, I don't have a show lined up. So I'm not saying there won't be a show next week. I am saying there might not be a show next week. So that's sort of the half pseudo announcement that I had because I have a lot of things I need to sort out with changes going on with mandates being imposed and lines to be crossed. Borders to be crossed potentially, and making sure that I make the best decisions that I can at this time for my family. So I'm sure that will give lots of people things to have questions about. But anyway, that's our show tonight on Sardar Udhem. So thank you for the recommendation to do this one. And Jared, thank you for being willing to come on and talk about another Indian film. I think that it might be your wheelhouse, even though there's a couple of other movies we've talked about over the years that I think we should do with you as well. So you will earn that a little professional movie reviewer badge before you know it, if we keep going at this pace.
Yeah, I like this international niche I've kind of found with you guys. I think if I ever, that's where I spend most of my time reading, is in the international world and kind of the US, wars over the years, British too, but I find that to be really, if I ever follow your guys' footsteps and start my own libertarian-based podcast, I think I want it to be like something to do with international libertarianism, the libertarianism applied to the world, and kind of talking to about things like that. Anyways, I don't know why I interrupted you with that, but
no, it's okay. It's okay. Just squeezing a little more content out of you, Jared.
Well, yeah, for real.
Thanks again. We'll, of course, have links to all your prior appearances and your various projects on our show notes page at lastnighter.com/203. And if you want to hear my sob story at the beginning, go to lastnighter.com/Patreon. You can hear the first 35, 40 minutes of me lamenting things impacting my life that might be impacting the show, which might be impacting your listening experience for the next little while here. But anyway, with that, we'll say goodnight from last night. Maybe we'll see you next week. Maybe we won't, but stay strong and fight the power, raise some fists in the air, not communist style, but in freedom and justice style. And we'll see you guys some point in the future. All right. Thanks, Jared. Thanks, Robert. See you guys later. All right, and just a few more minutes on the actual Anarchy podcast before we get into the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, which is after another musical interlude. So you're getting a little bit of bonus content if you know us from the actual Anarchy days. And I have I had a bunch of questions I wanted to keep going with, but we were already an hour and 35 minutes into this, and Jared, our guest, is on the East Coast, and it's late for him, and he's got a half-hour drive before he goes home. So I'm going to just boil it down to one question, and we'll get a rapid-fire answer. And you feel free to expound upon your response. But I'll go to you, Robert, first. Was Sardar Udhem justified in the murder? Can we call it a murder of O'Dwyer? Your take.
Was he justified in his murder? I would say he was carrying out the justice. I mean, he made a great... His point was excellent. You know, politicians, they write laws that... you know, govern the actions of the everyday folks. But when it's a government policy that murders tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, there's like zero repercussions. Like the politicians that, you know, like O'Dwyer, he's like a national hero. He goes on speaking tours. Mm-hmm. You know, he lives in his fancy house. He's still going hunting, still drinking brandy, sipping by the fire. There's no lynch mob out to get him. There's no cop that comes and arrests him. It was all done in service of the state, right? So like it's similar to war when they generals and soldiers are ordered to murder and kill people that they've never met before that aren't doing them any harm. I mean, these guys, those people were just sitting there, just minding their own business for the crime of sitting around, hanging out and talking. And I kind of wish the movie had gone into what the law was that they were protesting. Maybe I'll want to go back and look at that. The laws that they were protesting. And I imagine that they had to do with peaceful assembly, probably. Who knows? But they certainly had a, they had the curfew. And then they must have had something in place to say that you couldn't get together and talk. Much like in the COVID days. All of a sudden, you couldn't get together and talk and hang out. It was like that was a crime of some kind, mm-hmm. except it wasn't necessarily a revolutionary crime. It was just normal life.
It was
outlawed. But anyway, he was justified in killing him. My only regret is that he got to live another 20 years or so before he was found. He had to suffer the repercussions of his monstrous act.
Right. Yeah. And what you were just talking about reminded me of that drone strike that was responsible for killing, I think, 7 children and an aid worker or something. And it was supposedly initially reported as some, you know, terrorist.
Righteous right? bombing or whatever.
Yeah. And it turns out it was, you know, 7 kids and an aid worker. I don't know the total details on it. But then, of course, there was a tweet that said that the Department of Defense has investigated the situation and it was an honest mistake and no one's going to get in trouble. So
yep.
like you're saying, you know, it's like, okay, well, yeah, you just murdered a bunch of people, but you know, no big deal, whatever. So fucking terrible. But there's no responsibility, no culpability, no honor, I think in a lot of these things. And that's really terrible. But Jared, I'll go to you for the same question and then we can wind this one down. And thanks again for coming on. So Was Sardar Udham justified in killing O'Dwyer?
Yeah, I've already said I think it was more than justified. I think it was heroic. I think Sardar Udham should be, or I think Udham Singh, forgive me. I think Udham Singh should be known, you know, as wide as Gandhi is known, again, thankful that this movie was made. I'm thankful that I got to, you know, get this brief kind of introduction and taste of what there still is. You know, it's so true that the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know anything. And I just feel that way all the time. And this movie contributed to that, but was also, you know, really great at filling in some pieces that you know need to be filled in, because I do have come into contact with people from all kinds of cultures all the time. I've been good friends and worked closely with a lot of people from various parts of India, and you know, I haven't really gotten into much in the way of conversations other than hearing an expression of dislike for the British from one specific Indian friend of mine. A great job out of Bollywood, an achievement, everybody should see it. It's very very well worth it and very well done.
All right, well, thank you very much. Thanks again for coming on, and this has been a really good discussion. I think we could go on for a few more hours, but
easily.
Unfortunately we don't have time and it is late for you, so We were going to do a little bit of Kathleen Turner Drive. Maybe you'll drop off and just Robert and I will entertain the folks for a little bit longer. But this has been episode 260 of the Actual Anarchy Podcast. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/260. And we may or may not see you next week. But if we don't, or even if we do, I do wish you maximum freedom. And stay strong, everyone. We will see you sometime in the future down the road. Thanks.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot. Doot, doot, doot.